The show you have selected will start directly after the next message.
Welcome to the future you. Frank Lloyd Wright once said, "Study nature, love nature, stay close to nature, and it will never fail you." At Zija, we love nature. We study nature. In India, we discovered Moringa and created Moringa Supermix, a revolutionary new combination of organic ingredients, including natural vitamins, minerals, proteins, antioxidants, and omega oils. Zija's new Moringa Supermix will help you make a change for the better. Simply click on the Zija banner on the UKHealthRadio.com homepage. Power people need power vitality.
Hello and welcome to the Yes to Life show. My name's Robin Daly and I'm the founder of the UK charity Yes to Life, that's helping people with cancer to understand and access integrative medicine. One of the most exciting fields of development in integrative medicine is exercise, which is producing results that fly in the face of all the old bed rest advice of the past. In fact, it's fast becoming an essential ingredient of any cancer protocol. My guest today is a very fast-moving woman, an impressive triathlete, who's also a doctor with a dramatic health story of her own. I caught up with Dr. Tamsin Lewis, or Dr. Tam as she's known, who goes under the brand Sporty Doc, fresh off her bike in the midst of a hectic schedule.
Hello, Dr. Tam, really delighted to have the opportunity to talk to you today. Thanks for coming on the Yes to Life show.
Hi, I'm happy to be here, finally. A few logistical hurdles to make it happen, but we made it happen, which
is good. So, you're a qualified doctor, but your work is a world away from sitting behind a computer dispensing prescriptions to people with chronic conditions. In fact, I'd say you're in the vanguard of a revolution in the way we approach chronic illness, working in parallel with other doctors like Rangan Chatterjee and Rupi Aujla, but bringing your particular speciality into the mix, your passion for exercise. But before we go into that, I wonder if I can ask you about your own very personal health story that I think it's fair to say propelled you in this direction.
Yes, sure. So I had a fairly, and I've written and talked about it quite extensively. My early teens were spent as a sort of labelled with various things from depression, anxiety, anorexia, bulimia, obsessive compulsive disorder, all these different labels that really in retrospect now just were kind of not really helpful at all, or just, you know, symptoms of something that was underlying, which was essentially, you know, family dynamics going wrong. And one very astute doctor at the time, although I didn't realize it, said, "Well, your family's got the measles and you've just got the spots," which is kind of... you know, now in retrospect, I think, wow, he was actually looking at root cause. So, because that's exactly what it was, you know, it's just behaviours that, came about that were then labelled as an illness, which were actually just a body trying to control the immediate environment in, the way it could. So I had all those labels and didn't really understand much about really what they meant. And I felt, in fact, spent a lot of time fighting back against the conventional medical system, which was trying to sort of prescribe different medications for me. Was medicated from a young age, actually, probably from the age of about 13, 14 on and off till my early 20s with various types of antidepressants, sleeping tablets, anti-anxiety things. And it wasn't until in the midst of all that I thought there must be another way, but I just there wasn't, and you know, it wasn't immediately obvious to me. And you know, going back probably what are we now, you know, over 25 years, god, that makes me sound old, I'm 39, you know, the kind of movement we've got now with lifestyle medicine, nutritional medicine, the role of gut health, I mean, none of that was really talked about. It was, you know, the literature was there, but no one really knew, and I didn't have any clue. And you know, I spent, you know, I was mostly living on, you know, diet coke, apples, bagels, cereal, you know, a very low fat but high carbohydrate diet, taking the eating disorder aside of it, but, you know, the nutritional density of what I was living on was absolutely terrible. So it was almost like, you know, the fuel tank in all aspects, macro and micronutrients, was running really low. So it wasn't until I had a severe head injury in my final year of medical school. I was on a skiing trip with one junior doctor, final year medical student, and I wasn't wearing a helmet because back in 2004 it wasn't kind of popular, and sadly we were going off piste slightly and my ski got stuck. Anyway, kind of catapulted forward, landed, sat up, had a huge sense of deja vu, and then I passed out and started fitting on the slope. And thankfully I had the medical student and the junior doctor that was with me was able to resuscitate me, and they airlifted me with oxygen to Calgary, and I spent 3 days in a coma, and they told my parents I wouldn't come around. But the reason I'm saying that this is because the kind of support system around that, you know, once you've kind of, you're woken up and there's no lesions in your brain that they can obviously see and you haven't got a diagnosable illness, I was just left to the side to just get on with it.
Right. And
I had horrendous depression. I had horrendous insomnia. I had anxiety, you know, suicidality, all of which, because I was forced, I went back in and did my first year as a junior doctor, and you know, I'm very tenacious, so I kind of just tried to get on with it, but I was literally falling off, you know, the edge, basically. And I didn't know who to turn to, because every way I turned to doctors, they said that I needed more medication or I needed a different medication, and I slowly felt like I was losing sense of myself. And it took kind of getting rock bottom, you know, like turning to alcohol. I was on prescription sleeping medications, and then I suddenly thought, this is not me. And I'd always tried to do some exercise because I come from a very, you know, my father was a Tour de France cyclist, he was a professional athlete. I grew up around that and admired and respected that. My ex-boyfriend, it always comes back down to something that matters to you, had done a triathlon, and I remember going to watch it and remember thinking, that's incredible. How do people keep going for so long? And that was just an Olympic distance. And I woke up one day and I said, you know what, I'm just going to do this triathlon. And I'd signed up for one and I put it off for 2 years in a row. And then this year I said, right, I'm just going to do it. And I did a little bit of training. I literally jumped in the deep end at Blenheim Triathlon in Oxfordshire. And that was it for me. You know, I went through it and I did quite well. And I thought, right, this is something I can really gear myself and my attention to. And slowly, the discipline of doing, you know, exercise, of then fueling the exercise and looking around nutrient density and what I could do to improve performance really shifted my life around.
Right.
So I got very involved in the triathlon community, and through an extended period of time I actually got very good at triathlon, both as an amateur. I won the Amateur World Championship in 2008 whilst working full-time as a doctor.
Mm.
And then I got sponsorship to try it as a professional. And I was, you can think about it, I was probably 28 at this time, so it was pretty late on. And I seized the opportunity and with that performed as an elite athlete for about 5 years. Through that journey, and I won't bore you with the detail of that now, I learned and was introduced to a lot of people who thought about health differently.
Mm.
Most of this was from the States, and most of it initially people saw as pseudoscience and quackery and shut it down because there wasn't the, in inverted commas, evidence base. But when I started to think about it a bit more and go to conferences and listen to podcasts, and this was people like Dr. Rhonda Patrick, who's a PhD, Dr. Tommy Wood and Christopher Kelly and Nourish Balance Thrive in the States, and all that community, the primal health community, the paleo ancestral health community, I learned a lot through them and access to performance medicine. So I started to look at my own self and I started to say, right, if I'm here now and I'm performing this well, I started to look at my blood work, I started to get interested in gut health, I did some gut testing, and I got this framework, which I obviously had mentorship around from various people, about looking at blood work and other other medical tests differently. So instead of absence of disease, I was looking at it in an optimal health paradigm. So I was thinking, what if I get my iron level up to middle range, which is associated with improved, you know, oxygen delivery and therefore effects on performance. My magnesium levels, my hormones, you know, stabilizing them, my vitamin D levels, B12, choline, you know, all of those kind of, what we call them biomarkers, that sort of flags in your blood system that, you know, your body over time, if you get your own pattern, if you're able to see your blood test shift over time, you can recognize a pattern which correlates with when you're well, when you're performing well, you're feeling good, and when you're not so good. Mm-hmm. So I guess I'm trying to explain here that the athletic and the performance community drew me into a different world, which then helped me rethink my medical training and my medical background. And when I went back to practicing in the NHS, I felt very, very low again, because I saw how far behind we were in the way we approach health. And at that point, I was working in psychiatry, which I went into and studied. I did a postgraduate qualification in with the Royal College of Psychiatrists. So I got membership of the Royal College of Psychiatrists. And the reason for that was because I was fascinated about people and the way people are and the why behind the way people are and the fact that the physiology responds to the psychology. And actually, you know, having a chance to spend time with people helped me. But what I was limited by was the fact that the prescribing model is all very nice guidelines, all very, you know, trust guidelines. And if you treat depression, you know, if you have to diagnose depression, you have to put it in a box, and therefore you have to follow the prescribing guidelines for depression. So it's an SSRI first, so Prozac or sertraline, and then you move out. And so it's almost like you're hamstrung into approach, which I psychologically didn't feel happy with. One, because I'd had my own negative experience, and two, because it feels like a plaster. You know, if we're told, and we were taught at medicine more, but it was more like you know, just speaking about it rather than actually doing it, the biopsychosocial model. So the ultimate in, you know, well-being is the looking at your biology. So like I said, some of the blood tests, the gut tests, whatever tests, medical data, and then the psychology, which is the way people feel, behave, function, interact, and then sociology, which is community, purpose, life, and all that lifestyle things. And it's bringing that together to say, right, who is this person today and why are they presenting me with this problem? And giving them Prozac is literally not going to change that. But, you know, so I left the NHS before I became a consultant because I felt very unhappy in the model, and I'm not criticizing the NHS particularly in any way. I don't mean to, because I think it serves a really good purpose for, you know, for what it's trying to do, especially in an acute care model, but, you know, it can't keep up with the chronic disease burden. And when I say chronic disease, they're, you know, the big four that you you've talked about extensively too, you know, the diabetes, cardiovascular disease, mental health, and cancer. So a lot of those have underlying lifestyle drivers, which, you know, take a bit of time to kind of piece together. So I think that's a kind of high level insight into me. And I guess now what I do is quite nuanced. A part of my life is, you know, I joined the British Society of Lifestyle Medicine, and what they're doing now is training GPs, creating content events, you know, spreading the word about the power of lifestyle in preventing and modulating diseases. I work in a more optimal health paradigm, so I work with a lot of very high-performing individuals or people that want to be high-performing, that want to achieve as much as they can, and whether that be sport, life, work. So I spend half of my time doing that, consulting, and that involves a series of tests, which we are trying to create or work with a company that's creating a dashboard around collecting that data so that you as a consumer can understand your data better, your medical tests better, without needing a doctor to sit with you and circle things in red or black. Mm-hmm. I've always been very interested in patient empowerment and technology, as you increasingly know, especially in the US. We're lagging back behind here, but there are companies now coming out of the woodwork very quickly, is making your health information more understandable and more personalized. But personalized medicine, in which I work, you know, most of the time, is a very expensive approach currently, privately, because of the cost of the testing. And that will come down as big companies are more aware of the demand of the patient as a consumer. You know, people that want to understand their health, and they want to understand it without having to go and, you know, have the ownership with the doctor, or the nurse or the health coach. So the types of my approach and the types of testing that I do now are very, very 360. You know, it's taking a gut test, which looks at your microbiome, so the ecosystem within your gut. It looks at the health markers, the gut, inflammation, digestive function. That's one pillar. The other pillar I do is looking at a detailed blood test, as I said, in a very much an optimal paradigm with regards to certain nutrients and regards to certain hormones. So, and then finally, I do certain genetic tests, an epigenetic test, which is showing you which genes are being expressed. Work with a company called Chronomics, which is doing, it's the first company, it's out of Cambridge University, that is offering the consumer health a whole genome plus epigenetics test. So it shows you just your genetic risk, but actually which of those genes are being expressed. And even better then, how is your environment modulating your genetic expression and what you need to do about it. So that's fascinating. Putting that together with, you know, blood tests and gut testing, and then having a very intensive approach with, so I take people through all their data, and then I work with a nutritionist and health coach to support people in the necessary lifestyle changes necessary. And that can involve dietary changes, it can involve adding in supplements, it can involve certain medications, or then strategically changing up people's medications so that they aren't suffering from the side effects, or mitigating some of the damaging side effects of certain medications like statins, for example. So
it's a very full and rounded look at people's health, basically, and definitely not compartmentalizing them in the way that orthodox medicine traditionally does. I'm interested, first of all, just to go back to your experience of dealing with psychological problems. Obviously, the show is about integrative medicine for cancer, so I'm always looking at it from a sort of cancer perspective. Now, psychological issues play pretty large on the scene for people with cancer. The very thing about having cancer is pretty bad. The effect it has on people's lives is very bad. And even the effect of the treatments can be very depressing as well. There's a lot of things to struggle with mentally. How much of what you experienced, both in terms of actually dealing with having the condition and dealing with it in the ways that you found to deal with it, how much of that do you think translates to people with cancer?
I think basic principles can be applied here, because what we know, as you've mentioned, with the psychology behind here is, you know, mental health is key, right? And if there's a few things there. So you have to look at people's genetic risk to being depressed in the first instance. You then have environmental, you know, depression. So once you have the diagnosis, once you're going through all the treatment, that's obviously very difficult, even for the most robust, psychologically robust person to deal with. So I, and the underlying drivers there from a biochemical perspective is inflammation. And I don't know if you've read or alluded to a book called Inflammation in Mind.
I don't know that one.
Sorry, The Inflamed Mind by Ed. It's a King's College neuroscientist who was looking at the drivers of depression, and that inflammatory markers in the blood correlated with people's experience of depression. So why he's saying that is that if you modulate your body's inflammation levels, then that can affect how you feel and how resilient you are to deal with the stress that cancer will cause. And there are pillars there. So that can be an anti-inflammatory diet. So a diet high in good fats, that's low in refined sugars, all the basic principles there. There's also certain supplements that can help. And now the evidence base goes back and forth, because it's very difficult because certain supplements help certain people and they don't help other people. So it's a bit of trial and error with yourself. I have found that a liposomal form of turmeric called theracumin, or like a liquid form of turmeric that's very well absorbed. There is evidence that it can significantly modulate inflammation. It also has anti-cancer properties in and of itself. I use high potency form of fish oil, omega-3, in people. So there's the dietary approach, there's the supplementary approach, and then there's a lifestyle approach. You know, we know that cardiovascular fitness reduces inflammation in the body. We know that if that's difficult for people who, obviously, if you're physically unwell, if you're going through chemo or you do have cancer, that things like saunering is a good proxy for exercise, even so much as hot baths. They can really stimulate, help modulate that immune and inflammatory process in the body. Right. And from a psychological standpoint, you know, community, and you know, being with people, having a good support structure can really help with your body's, the impact that any inflammation or stress has on the body.
Right.
Okay. So there's a few things there. And obviously, working on sleep, circadian rhythm where possible. So, you know, bright light in the morning, especially at times of the year like this when there isn't any bright light. I recommend people get one of those anti-sad lights with that very blue light, light box. Have that on your desk in the morning or around in the kitchen when you're creating breakfast or doing whatever you do in the morning. And then really making sure that you have less blue light in the late afternoon, evening, which can interfere with melatonin production, which prevents deep sleep. And obviously you need to have deep recuperative sleep if the body's trying to recover and heal in the best way possible.
Mm-hmm. Great. Thank you. I'd also like to tie in a bit with your story of your accident. So clearly this was a major, almost fatal event. But it seems like the after effects were diffuse and kind of hard to connect back to the accident itself, at least when looked at from a conventional point of view. So I'd be interested to know how that experience affected your view of how the body functions and therefore of how health practitioners need to respond to problems.
Yeah, that's a very good question, Robin. Thanks. Like I said, it was difficult at the time because we didn't really know, because, you know, and I have to preface this with, I think James Cracknell did a lot good for traumatic brain injury in people, and helping shift the medical understanding and people's understanding of the impact of head injuries and you know, just because you can't measure something doesn't mean it's present. And what I've become increasingly interested in now is using sort of wearables, you know, like people know very much like a Fitbit, so things that monitor your sleep. I use something called an Oura Ring, O-U-R-A, which gives me a stress score because it monitors heart rate variability, which is the beat-to-beat variation in your heart rate, which, if out of balance, can indicate that there's excessive stress in the body. So it kind of, on a day-to-day basis, it seems to predict when I'm run down or when I'm getting run down or getting a cold, and when I'm like good to go or had a good night's sleep or my system's strong. So I've been very interested in that, and I think that's where a lot of medicine will be going, is remote patient monitoring, because you know, you see your doctors infrequently, you see nurses infrequently. There's a lot of things that on a day-to-day basis don't get tracked, and often we put on a good face or bad face depending on who we are when we go to see our healthcare professionals. So actually collecting information outside of the medical setting is really helpful. And they will increasingly become affordable over time. So I think to go back to your question, it's the measurement of things. So we know that, you know, if my follow-up MRI brain scan was normal, it was initially they showed brain inflammation, but nothing else, and I was having seizures. So, but they subsided. So they couldn't label me as having, you know, brain damage per se, and they couldn't label me as having epilepsy. But, you know, the symptoms were caused by an inflamed brain. That is because my brain was shook up so long. So I think I think medical technology will be over time be able to measure things a bit more accurately. So inflammation in the brain now is difficult to measure. We can do it, but we can do it via some very expensive blood tests, which outside a research environment are not being used unless you know really what to ask for at a private lab. But I think we can, as a proxy, so as a, you know, we can track people's stress scores, we can track people's mood scores, and we, you know, we can then know at which point we need to intervene. And you know, I think I go back to having a being part of a support system, being your own health advocate. So you know, if you're insightful about your own body, you can really know what makes it tick and what makes it doesn't, and you can notice if you pay attention to it, when you feel good and when you don't. Mm-hmm. And what I like about using things like the Oura Ring and you know other wearables, Fitbits, the Apple Watch does it as well, is that it's almost like it makes it captures information to make you accountable for your health. So if you went out, if you had too many glasses of wine, it impacts your sleep and you get a bad score, and or if you ate too late at night, it impacts your deep sleep and by increasing your body temperature. So I think that is definitely an era that's coming. So people can track themselves at home and then they can come to their doctor and they can say, well, look, over the past month, I've been, you know, this is what happened to me. And I think it's then working with like-minded clinicians that can really sort of empower you to live better. I think there's a lot of, you know, misinformation out there at the moment, especially like enforced by the Daily Mail, that basically blanket says, you know, all supplements bad. There's no evidence they work. But if you look at the detail, you know, the evidence is, you know, really wide populations. They're not specific. They're not dose adjusted. The quality of the supplements isn't good often. And so I think there's a lot of muddying of the water there.
Right.
So for me, it's almost like, I know how bad I used to feel in, you know, late 20s, early 20s, you know, when I was after the head injury. And, you know, the head injury had lasting effects. I mean, even on me now, if I'm tired or run down, I have problems with speech and language centres. And right. I've had neurofeedback. I don't know if you know.
I don't know what that is.
I mean, it's very practitioner independent. Essentially, they scan your brain activity, and they can see where there's areas of high blood flow and low blood flow. So which area has damaged, and the practitioner that did it with me could see the mechanism of my head injury back to forth and a shake on the brainstem without me telling her. So you know, these things do have lasting effects, and you know, even so much as anesthetics, we now know that they, you know, periods of, you know, reduced blood flow to the brain in susceptible people can have lasting effects, but they're often not big enough in and of themselves to be diagnosed as any problem. And a problem with conventional medicine is that because we don't know what to do about it, we almost say it's not there.
Ignore it.
Whereas I say, well, surely, look, there's got to be something here, and that almost seems to always be a reason, right? And often it is psychological, and I don't think people should just say, oh, it's just psychological. I think they should then go, well, what is the psychology? Let's just explore that, because if you're then more aware of that, then your body feels in a safer place to go, huh, I'll divert resources to healing. It's a really complex system, but I'm increasingly interested in it because I'm fortunate to work with people intensively and really uncover the why behind how they are. I see that sort of layers of trauma in people, and trauma doesn't have to be, you know, really, you know, horrible things. It can just be, you know, life experiences and life events that have gone unprocessed. That can all layer and really impact your immune system. And I suggest, I don't know if you know about someone called Dr. Gábor Máté. So it's really worth looking up his work, because I mean, he's a psychiatrist who does a lot of work with chronic disease, and he talked about how trauma as as event-based or whatever your life experiences, how that can affect how your immune system, which is obviously really important in cancer, can become dysregulated and can therefore result in diseases and hamper recovery from diseases. This is new to me, this, you know, almost in the last 8 months. He did a podcast with Tim Ferriss. I don't know if you know him.
No, Tim Ferriss, yes.
Yeah, so Tim Ferriss did a very good, it's worth you watching on YouTube, podcast with Gab and Marty about trauma and how that affects the disease process. So I listened to that and I thought, wow, this is big. But then you need to go back to what do you do about it? Do we all need to then work with trauma therapists, you know, psychologists who are very well trained in dealing and unpicking trauma and helping you move forward? And then I went down the rabbit hole of looking at the use of psychedelics that are coming more into the fore now in terms of modulating stress responses and also in end-of-life experiences. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you're aware of Michael Pollan, the science journalist.
Yes, I am, yeah. Yeah, very interesting area.
It is. So that's, again, another thing that I'm looking at. And I know the researchers at Imperial are looking at doing a trial at the moment with psilocybin, which is the active ingredient in magic mushrooms.
Yes.
So, yeah. Well, so it's all kind of, I love the way that it's all kind of coming together now. And we can't practice this isolated medicine anymore, this kind of super specialty where everyone goes and goes, well, I don't want to look at your thyroid today because that's my specialism. And, slap on, you know, thyroxine for the thyroid, and then you're not looking at the other system, which is obviously affected because the body works as a whole. And GPs aren't, you know, they're almost not GPs anymore. They're just signposting people out to clinically defined pathways, which takes the personalization out of it. And we are people. You know, common things are common. Patterns do repeat themselves. But, you know, we shouldn't be predetermining people's health before we've even seen them. You know, we really need to have time to listen to them. And I think what I'm fascinated by now is what technology can do to support doctors and clinicians to make the right choices for the people they have right in front of them. Mm. Because it is going to be an era of personalized medicine. Big pharma are going more that way now, you know, which drugs suit different genotypes. And, you know, Theresa May's given some funding to that initiative this year. So I think we need to be training doctors in a different paradigm to understand data and to understand technology and to listen to people. And if they aren't doctors listening, then having very well trained practitioners that can serve that purpose.
Right. Yeah, in all the kinds of compartmentalization that go on, the one you've talked about quite a bit there, between a psychological problem and a physical problem, is a very interesting one, because the harder you look, the less you're able to find the dividing line between the two, is how I've seen it. And it seems like a problem is a problem, and it will, in most cases, it strays into both areas, and it can be helped in both areas as well.
Yes, it certainly can, and I should say that my own personal experience with patients is that, you know, there's a lot of resistance to looking at that, because they feel if they open up psychologically, then they're vulnerable. Right. And if they're vulnerable, then they feel less resilient to deal with what they actually need to do on a day-to-day basis. Mm-hmm. So often that can be scary, and if you let your defense systems down, even if over time it's impactful, I think in the actual moment, people can find that quite overwhelming, and they could feel like they're being judged. So I think it's a difficult path to tread. I think it's being helped by conversations like we're having, like Tim Ferriss had with Gabor Mate, you know, that you can go out there and say, look, it's okay to admit that you're not quite coping. You know, you do not have to be Superman day in, day out, because you know what, if you accept a little bit more support and guidance and that you can be a bit vulnerable, then your body will thank you, and it will say, right, give me a bit of a break here, you know. And then overall, that that can really help the healing process.
Okay. Can I come back now to one of your main things, which is exercise, and try and look at that in connection with cancer? I mean, it's been heralded as the new wonder drug, you know, for people with cancer. And indeed, the research is showing that if it was a drug, a manufacturer could easily be charging $100,000 a patient for it on the basis of the results it gets. Do you have much experience in the arena of supporting people with cancer through exercise and indeed maybe more broadly with lifestyle medicine?
Well, personally, I don't have, but indirectly, I used to. The journey into this space started off at the Centre for Health and Human Performance at 76 Harley Street.
Mm-hmm.
And they run certain programs with cancer patients. And so I learned indirectly through that, you know, guided exercise protocols had huge impact in improving people's mood and modulation of immune and inflammatory processes. So that definitely is Dr. Jack Kreimler who helped set that up, and Jack was one of my earliest mentors in this space and is an incredible chap. From my perspective, I think it's very hard to prescribe because I think there's such an inter-individuality in what exercise people enjoy. And I think one thing you need to take away this from the studies is that if exercise becomes loathed or stressful, it's probably not going to do you as much good if you actually feel good after the exercise. So pushing you to the point of exhaustion and feeling terrible is, you know, if done consistently, is not going to be a healthy thing. Pushing you to a point where you feel slightly pushed and then you can come back from it and then you recuperate and then you go again is going to cause adaptive changes which will be beneficial. So if you force a rat to run on a treadmill, even though they get cardiovascular fitter, they actually get more depressed because their cortisol levels go up. So there needs to be a nuance there. So finding exercise that works for you, you know, some people absolutely hate going to the gym. I often tell people that I think exercise is far more beneficial if you're either with people or if you're in light, if you're in nature and outside. Or some people find being in water very, very healing. I personally do. And I also think there's a big benefit, as I said, from other ways that get your heart rate up that aren't exercise, like saunering. There's promising research around that. And also hot magnesium baths get your heart rate up. So find what you like, do more of it, do it with people, and do it outside if possible.
Okay, thank you.
Not by a busy road.
Yeah, right. Particularly not in London. Okay, so last couple of things as we're getting towards the end. I just wanted, out of interest, you did a sort of classic medical training. You've then gone on and moved very much into a broader territory. Where did you go to get the training for what you're doing?
So I don't have any formal training in integrative or functional medicine. And the reason is because I've been to so many conferences and done so many different modules online that when I then spoke to someone at the Institute of Functional Medicine, which is an organisation out of the States that gives people degrees in or qualifications in functional medicine,
mm-hmm.
I thought it would be a very expensive thing to do, and I thought it would be very time intensive, and I knew a lot of it already having looked at the modules. So I did not do that training. People choose to. But again, it's expensive, and you don't have to be a doctor to do it. You can do it as a chiropractor, a nutritionist, or osteopath. So I didn't see the value in doing that. As I said, the British Society for Lifestyle Medicine now run a diploma. They run patient education groups.
Mm-hmm.
My early understanding and interest in this came from a book called The Disease Cure by Jeffrey Bland.
Yes.
You know it?
I do.
Yeah. So him, and then I looked at Chris Kress's work. I find his content online is fantastic. It's so I've met Chris Kress and done a couple of conferences with him.
Mm-hmm.
He's got an academy that trains practitioners, which is very good and very clinically applicable for a lot of people. I've had my business partner, whom you know, Victoria Fenton. She did the whole Quiz Classicals and is an incredibly skilled practitioner, even though she's not a medical doctor. She does a lot of what they call mindset medicine and works on gut health, which is, you know, it's the pinnacle to a lot of other health parameters. So my traditional training was King's College London. I did Masters in Surgery and Medicine, and then I did postgraduate qualification in neuroscience. So I have a bachelor's in neuroscience, which in retrospect, even though I didn't like writing essays on different protein transcribing systems, has all helped in the knowledge and the way I practice today. So medicine gave me a very good sort of robust system for and a high sort of BS monitor in my head. So interesting way of approaching things. And then obviously my psychiatry training definitely affects how I process and approach things today. I recommend people do a lot of their own thinking and their own research and reading in this. You know, there's incredible information out now through podcasts. High intensity health podcasts. I think Tim Ferriss has some good health people on there. Dr. Rhonda Patrick, her podcast Found My Fitness is amazing. Dr. Peter Attia, he's a longevity MD in the States. Fascinating, you know. One of my strongest mentors is a PhD doctor called Dr. Tommy Wood, who trained in Oxford. He is a medical director of Nourish Balance Thrive in the States. So, you know, it's surrounding yourself with sort of knowledge and mentor groups. And, you know, I'm constantly talking and thinking with these people to bounce ideas off and evolve a way of practicing. But, you know, the only criticism is at the moment is it's fairly... If you get a lot of data on people and you have a lot of people's time, it's expensive. But that will go down over time as more, as bigger companies will fund this approach, because essentially, you know, it's cost effective over time because goes down. And obviously, Rangan, what Rangan Chatterjee is doing is great. You know, his approach and speaking out about the pillars of life, which people find very boring: eat, sleep, move, relax. But actually, you know, they're big ones. And now I have, you know, my own accountability structure with my Aura ring. I'll show you a picture afterwards. You saw Prince Harry is wearing one, so the world's gone crazy for them.
Okay, well, that's great. Thank you for that. And you've already mentioned the other thing I wanted to ask you about, which is the British Society for Lifestyle Medicine. You're a founding member. There's quite a lot of practitioners listen to the Yes Life Show. So do you want to say what the aims of the organisation are and who can join?
I do. And to be honest, it is evolving all the time.
Okay.
They're trying to get an education system around which part of your life affects your risk of developing certain diseases. And, you know, they have... a membership program, they have community events, they've got a sort of hashtag approach, which is One Change, which is basically saying, you know, choose something you do daily, like brush your teeth, and then, you know, how could you do that better? And then every time you do it better, you know, reinforce the fact that you've done it better, and that these small steps over time really do have an impact long term. They have their, you know, BSLM have their own certification now, the Diploma in Lifestyle Medicine, which is great, which is making more doctors are more aware of the impact of lifestyle on disease, and even better knowing what to do about it, because, you know, it's doctors still have an authority base, you know. People will go and want to listen to what we think is right. I have noticed that more and more people do challenge it. You know, they come home and they've got a prescription and they look at it and they go, well, do I really need to take 2 weeks of antibiotics?
All right.
But I think if you can describe yourself as being open-minded and aware of the research on lifestyle impact and disease, and that is dietary, that is environment, you know, pollution, air travel, the air quality in your home, you know, whether even so much as whether you use gas burners, you know, that's accumulated burden that your body then has to deal with. And I think, as I said, the cost of the test to measure these things objectively is high, but they won't always be. So we'll be able to see more and more the impact of your environment on your health on a day-to-day basis. I should, there's a there was an article published recently which you should probably link to. It's called The Next Best Thing in Health is Your Exposome, which is basically saying that our health is a combination of genetics and environment. And it's capturing information on how your body reacts on a daily basis to the exposures of different things in the environment. And what comes out of it is that, you know, I think we're increasingly realise that it's quite primitive the way we practice medicine at the moment in the super specialised area of isolating different organ systems. But because it's so overwhelming to try and manage everything for an individual practitioner, we need to, you know, get technology, machine learning, AI over time to help, you know, flag up things, which then a doctor can then look at and go, right, yes, that is a problem, or it's not. So I really like this whole idea of good technology, self-monitoring, remote patient monitoring, flagging systems, so that doctors don't have all the burden on managing everything, because we now know that that's just not possible.
Okay, sounds like a good route. So do you need to be a doctor to be a member of the society?
You do not. There is, you can join the BSLM and you can support them and you can go to the conferences. You have, if you are a member, you have access to an online community, discounted access to the journal which is coming, email newsletters, and access to different doctors who are registered in lifestyle medicine. I think it's about £120 for a year.
Yeah.
And so the conferences bring together like-minded people, really get people up and moving. And, you know, Rob Lawson, who was the original instigator to all this, is working tirelessly on it. And, you know, hats off to him, because a lot of us, other practitioners who are founding members, are, you know, super, super busy trying to do things in our own way. But you have to realise if you want big impact, you need big systems, and you need to get
you
need to be doing things like we're doing now and getting the word out to more people, and not just siloing practitioners into, you know, expensive private clinics, working intensively, actually capturing information and reaching more people.
Too true. All right, we're going to have to end it there, Dr. Sam. Thank you very much indeed. It's been fascinating. This is obviously a territory you've put an immense amount of thought and time and effort into, and so you've got some great stuff to say about it. And I'm very interested in your whole attitude towards technology and how it can help us to narrow down this mass of data to get home in on the bit that's really important. So, great. Thank you very much indeed.
Can I say 1 minute on that?
Because
I set up a company back in 2011 called Curio 7, which was basically came out of my frustration as an athlete and other athletes to be able to get blood test information from doctors. They're like, you know, you have a blood test and then it takes a period of time, you have to chase it up, and then they send you a sheet of paper that means nothing. So I partnered with a company called Inside Tracker in the US, which basically visualized your blood test. So you saw in a range where was optimal, where was bad, and where was good, and what you could do about that in terms of supplementation and diet. That has always been my base interest in getting information that can empower people to understand their data and not having the data in the doctor's hands all the time. Allowing patients to be able to track and see their own health information is something that I'm really passionate about.
Oh, very, very good reason why as well. Brilliant. I'm right with you there. All right. Good. Thank you so much, Dr. Tam.
Thanks, Robin. Have a good day.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Dr. Tam mentioned many resources there, which you can find on the Yes to Life website. That's yestolife.org.uk. Just click the show logo on the homepage. Next week, I'm talking to top cancer specialist Professor Carol Sikora. He's been on the show before talking about his useful book, The Streetwise Patient's Guide to Surviving Cancer. Do check that out in the meantime, by the way, by going to the Yes to Life show page on UK Health Radio and putting his name, Sikora, S-I-K-O-R-A, into the search box. And while you're there, do have a browse of the back catalogue of over 175 shows. Anyway, this time, he'll be explaining his initiative to make proton beam therapy available to people in the UK. I hope you can join me again. Goodbye.